Hello. In the confused chronologies of real life and the constructed timelines of the Napoleonic Quarterly, certainly time is very flexible. And another complication in that regard is that whereas you've been listening to these episodes on a daily basis, in fact, in the real life in which we're recording them, it's been a week since the last one. So I feel a little bit removed from the Napoleon movie Quarter Hourly project, but maybe that's a good thing because this third act is a bit of a retread, I suppose. Here we are going again with Napoleon Bonaparte, and here we are on the Napoleon movie Quarter Hourly with me, Alex Stevenson, going again with screenwriter James Topham. Hello, James.
Hello, Alex. It is lovely to be here, as always.
James, I'm in your hands. We have struggled vainly to try to understand and therefore sympathise with the filmmaking decisions made that might collectively help us feel a bit better about this whole Napoleon brackets 2023 close brackets situation. Maybe in this penultimate 15 minutes, everything's going to be all right. I don't know. I suspect not. But let's see what you can come up with to help me feel better about all this.
Well, it feels like we're very much on the cusp, doesn't it? It feels like we've been doing this a lifetime, which is sure what...
That's the spirit.
Ridley Scott felt by this point in the film as well. But yeah, let's dive in, Alex. I'm sure this last 30 minutes is going to completely turn around your feelings about the film and your listeners as well. So if you remember last time, Alex, Napoleon had just been intercepted on his march back from Elba. He's marching to his true love, Josephine, who he fears is being nobbled by the baby Russian Tsar. And he is stopped in his tracks by a general who orders his men to bear arms and point their muskets at Napoleon.
An officer anywhere.
But, you know, this much older, more stately Napoleon, you know, certainly more stately than we've seen him previously, even a few moments before when he was furiously beating a newspaper against a coffee table.
It's progress, yeah.
He walks calmly towards those guns and he asks his soldiers, "Do you recognise me?" Now, he is wearing the classic Napoleon hat at this point, which might be a bit of a giveaway to the soldiers.
Yeah, it was definitely was it a rhetorical question? Because ultimately, that silence was getting pretty awkward.
It was, but, you know, classically not a rhetorical question because one of the soldiers replies, "Yes."
And that is what I call dialogue. Yes, yes.
Yeah, yes. Napoleon manages to sweet-talk the soldiers, and in what is a sort of an I am Spartacus-type moment, all the men-at-arms throw down their guns and run to their ex-leader and embrace him.
And there's suitable jostling.
There's patting on backs, there's kind of like heaving to and fro. It felt like a bit like a mosh pit when the singer dives headfirst into the crowd.
And yet Napoleon Bonaparte doesn't have any hit singles to turn to. I don't know, maybe Austerlitz or his old battles might count as the Napoleonic version of hit singles. But it did seem to me that there wasn't necessarily much of a rationale for this turnaround because we haven't seen any scenes where there's been a relationship developed between Napoleon and the body of his troops as a whole.
How can you say that, Alex, when, of course, only a few minutes ago he was giving out those tiny pieces of bread to men on the retreat from Russia? Look, it felt weird, this scene. It felt lacking in tension in that at no point was I worried that these men were going to shoot Napoleon. But also, yeah, didn't seem to give much of a reason for them to turn around.
And the problem with this scene is it is directly up against the infinitely superior version in the film Waterloo, brackets 1970, close brackets, in which Rod Steiger absolutely does the business and this whole scene's given a bit more room to breathe.
Now, Alex, we haven't talked about this off the pod, but you did send me a very ominous text message earlier in the week bearing the information that there's been a re-release of a astonishingly long Napoleon film. Is that your plan for season two?
Well, Napoleon brackets 1927, close brackets, I think that's the right date, is, I think, 6 hours long. And the press release, it's a silent film, and it was a movie masterpiece. Honestly, look at the trailer. It's so good and so exciting, and I'm very, very interested in it. It's not a film I've seen before. They'd done up a DVD version of it back in the early years of the 21st century, but it's been 16 years in the making, this new digitization version of it. And I don't know whether it might work as a screenwriting project because it's a silent film.
Maybe you can get someone else to sit through those 30 episodes with you, Alex.
Okay.
Okay, anyway, the soldiers bear Napoleon back to Malmaison only to find, and this is big, Alex, this is a big, big moment in the film. Obviously, Josephine has been the lodestar for Napoleon throughout his story. And what does he find when he arrives? Her dead.
Dead.
Dead as a doornail.
Well, what he actually finds is her daughter, Hortense, who I had thought was just a lady in waiting. It took me, I was very embarrassed, and I realised that she was actually the daughter.
Yeah, she's the maid in my notes as well.
But he was kind of treating her a bit like a maid.
He does indeed. And look, he doesn't take the death at all well. He's snotty-nosed. He's all over the shop, even more so than Napoleon tends to be in these scenes. First, he seems angry with her. Then he asks whether she blames him for his treatment of her mother. You know, and he's yet again, Alex, he's portraying some of those childish qualities that you so rightly flagged up a couple of episodes ago.
Well, it reminded me a bit, just echoes of that most interesting bit of the Josephine-Napoleon relationship between minutes 30 and 45 of this film, where the power dynamic is shifting drastically. And there's a little bit of that here, where he's happy to go one way and then the other in terms of being a grovelling groveller and then actually being the person in charge of it all.
Yeah. And then, of course, the scene ends rather pathetically in that they get into this sort of long-winded discussion about how she kept her letters in her bedside table and now they've possibly been stolen by the valet, and, you know, the import of which I can't possibly fathom there, other than perhaps people talk complete nonsense when they're grieving.
Given that they decided to miss out Trafalgar and they decided to miss out the Peninsular War, but they decided to keep in the valet.
The valet, yeah, valet gate, yeah. Weird historical... historical accuracy there, I think. But look, I guess that's the end of the Josephine subplot, right? Because we move on almost immediately.
It's not a subplot. It's really the only significant thread in the film, because Napoleon's rise and fall in terms of power is just... It's not a story, is it, James? I'm being very negative today, but... And so, therefore, must turn to you to try and... come on, you've got to pull something out here that'll make me feel better about this.
Well, look, I think the film leans heavily on Josephine, doesn't it? And I think there's good reasons for that. I think their relationship is, you know, very interesting. But it's a big problem for the film that Josephine dies when she does, because we've got this whole lot of stuff to happen subsequent to it. And it sort of feels like what is the ending of the film happens like 25 minutes before the ending of the film, right? I think we sort of lose what was interesting about this film.
Okay, so what about this, James? If I was Sir Ridley Scott and I was saying to you, okay, the one thing that I definitely want to change from historical reality, which I don't think Napoleonic geeks would actually mind, is let's have Josephine die in Napoleon Bonaparte's arms.
Yes.
After his return to power. Would that have been something that would have got your screenwriter's eyes lighting up?
At Waterloo. Right, they both go into battle. She perhaps takes a bullet for Napoleon.
Come on,
not spoilers. There is going to be.
Come on.
I think, look, I don't, I think it could be quite effective to have her die off screen, right? It's sort of kind of quite pathetic that he's returning home to see her and doesn't quite make it on time. I think that's kind of quite cool. I think it happening before the most significant end moment in the film, you know, the kind of before Waterloo and before his fall, I think feels a problem here.
He's there. It's the eve of Waterloo, and he gets this letter from Hortense that says bad news. Josephine's literally just died, and he's like, "Oh no!" And then that explains his defeat.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Just as the Austrians are coming over the, just as the Prussians are coming over the horizon.
That's the one. That's the one.
Look, you don't have me on here for my knowledge of Napoleonic history, Alex. Look, but one thing I do know is I know the Congress of Vienna, Alex, which is what's coming on like a freight train towards us, sort of a little bit muted, I feel, in its portrayal here, more like the dinner party of Vienna. There's about six people at it. Is that historically accurate?
Well, the Congress of Vienna was more a festival of socialising that revolved around daily balls. It was astonishing how the... essentially, European society convened in one city for, what was it, 9 months, 12 months? It went on and on for ages. And I think the key ingredient there was different people talking to each other.
Ah.
And perhaps one weakness of this film's depiction of the Congress of Vienna is that there was no dialogue per se. It was more just a speech of Wellington laying down how it goes.
Look. When you have achieved the casting coup that is waiting 8.5 tenths into your film to unveil Rupert Everett playing the Duke of Wellington, you're not going to give other people much screen time. What do you think, Alex? What do you think of Rupert Everett as the Duke of Wellington? Is it a masterstroke or stunt casting of the worst kind?
It's not stunt casting. It's definitely a masterstroke. It's a tremendous. He's brilliant as Wellington. He's a fantastic cast. Is that the right way to say it?
He's a fantastic cast, yes. look, he's very good. He's doing a lot of acting. He's acting hard, as we say in the biz. And he's managed to gather together, I suppose, a veritable hoo-hoo of people who don't like Napoleon. So we've got, you know, classic characters from the past. We've got Baby Tsar. We've got Fat King Louis, who didn't get much screen time, but is present. And even the sinister butler from the 2023 motion picture Saltburn, who I don't remember falling out with Napoleon, but obviously he has done at some point, perhaps off screen.
They didn't fall out. Talleyrand is the master pragmatist and was playing an absolute blinder. And that is a film I want to see. I want to see the biopic of Talleyrand. Yes, please.
You love that butler. So you kind of referred to Wellington's speech, a bit one-sided. He says...
It's a bit strong as well, wasn't it? Vermin.
It was a bit strong.
Vermin.
The vermin has routed the farms of Europe while the farmers snored.
I mean, no one...
Which feels like a bit of a mixed metaphor.
It's a bit confused. And I think makes that stand out is that it involves emotion and actual sort of feeling and views and opinions, which seems a bit unexpected because it's not something that that's really been a feature of the film and the screenwriting so far. You have a contrast there, don't you? Is that a deliberate thing, do you think, screenwriter-wise?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think it's possible that they've just got a good actor for the first time in the film, but no. Also, I think it's very clear that the screenplay is picking up Wellington as sort of the late stage antagonist, and because of that, he is crafting the case against Napoleon, and it's one that I think the film has been building kind of since we started. Right, he's egotistic, he's ambitious. and most galling of all, it seemed, to Wellington, he has a simple lack of good manners.
Yes, and that's a throwback to Lord Whitworth turning his head at the hour mark in this film and saying, "It's a pity such a great man should have such bad manners."
You're bringing it back, Alex, for that.
I think that's my favourite line, possibly of the period, but certainly of this film.
Look, and it's obviously something we've seen a lot of, you know, all that kind of Corsican stuff.
Well, we've seen a bit of it. I mean, they could have really gone for it.
I feel like hours. I feel like we've seen hours of it, Alex, of him being socially awkward in social situations.
No, but they, well, yeah, okay, they could have done more. Okay, all right, I suppose. Yeah, okay.
Folded. But I wonder, Alex, if it's also, there's a little bit of Hollywoodism creeping in here as well, you know, kind of Napoleon as like a self-made American upstart, and you know, after all, Joaquin Phoenix is playing
American.
Him with an American accent.
Well, and, the accent. I think we need to talk about the accent some more.
But, you know, but obviously, you know, Wellington is very much kind of like the old enemy, a kind of class-ridden Britain. You know, I think it's very classic American film to see everything through the War of Independence.
Well, Corsican, American, is that a sufficient justification for the retention of an American accent in just one fairly important character?
Syllable. No, I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, it's a real mess. It's a real mess having, because his brother doesn't speak with an American accent, does he?
So. I don't know whether it's just me being British English, but I would love to hear the views of American listeners as to whether it bothers you that, or whether because you're very American, being all American and all, you just don't notice, and it doesn't. I don't know. I would be curious to hear your views. Please send them to napoleonicquarterly@gmail.com or, you know, whatever.
don't just send them to whatever.
Okay.
Next, Alex, we get a classic map scene. Again, it's sort of a Star Wars vibe to it. You know, the gathering before the assault on the Death Star in A New Hope. Obviously, Napoleon doesn't have X-wing fighters, but he does have a number of flags on sticks, really big flags on really big sticks, just so we're really clear on what's going on from a battle perspective.
Yeah.
He lays it out. He says the odds are against them, but, you know, crucially, this battle is on land, and we've established that the British don't know fighting on land as well as he does. And then the place he will strike them, Napoleon says, is here. And he points to the map, and we slowly zoom in on Waterloo, baby. We made it. It was at this point in watching the film where I thought, actually, this podcast that I'm doing with Alex might end one day.
Yes, here we are. We've made it. As listeners know, the Napoleonic Quarterly is clinging on to what still feels an unbelievably distant prospect, Waterloo. But, hey, this came around pretty quickly, didn't it? It only took actually still quite a lot of time to get here, but here we are. Waterloo baby.
And of course, it being Waterloo, it's raining. We get a random soldier coming up to Napoleon suggesting to him that this is the right time to start fighting, but Napoleon, once again showing his tactical genius, suggests that they should wait until the rain stops.
I thought it was a great line.
And so, look, the armies then hang out for what feels like an inordinate amount of screen time. There's a lot of walking about, there's a lot of Wellington drinking tea.
But surely as a screenwriter, you would recognise that this is all about building tension.
Yeah, there's a little bit of an attempt at tension building. I think what you tend to do in screenwriting terms is kind of establish the central conflict between your two characters.
Ooh.
You know, you'd want to be like, okay, these are two very different men. And they're about to, we're about to see two different worldviews thrust against each other, and the better one winning. As it turns out, they are both pretty similar in their approaches to the battle. They're both like, I don't really want to fight when it's raining.
No, exactly. It's all about, you do see that big difference. It comes down to whether one of them would use an umbrella or not. Their attitudes to rain.
Classic. Classic.
Is there a sort of half attempted go at making the British Wellington seem a sort of little bit foppish, the sort of inheritor of Lord Whitworth's Regency manners, and just him being, but he's not developed at all. I think a lot of what's doing the work here is Rupert Everett's slightly sneering mouth.
He's got a very good mouth. There's no doubt about that. His mouth is doing, I'd say, 95% of the work.
I would say it's doing... Well, I texted you beforehand to say we were going to spend 80% of the time talking about Rupert Everett's mouth. You've, although unrelated, you've kind of increased the ante to 95% of the acting. Yeah, I would say 97, 98%. I mean, his eyes, his nose, no, I think it's all in the mouth. It's supercilious.
Certainly is. It's a wonderful mouth. He does try to, I suppose, give an impassioned speech, though again, not massively heavy in detail in terms of what he's going to expect his army to do.
Okay.
He wants them to be patient. He wants them to hold their ground.
I'm going to have to stop you there, because we need to talk about something that I think Napoleonic types will have noticed, that what we're seeing in the dialogue used by Wellington is basically a mashup of all of the various semi-apocryphal things that he is supposed to have said around the time of the battle and otherwise. And it's almost as if the screenwriter has gone through the bios and all the books and written down the good lines, and then he's got them all in front of him on post-it notes, and he reaches out and he grabs them, and it's I think he says something like, "Now's your time, boys, now's your time," which is famously what he says at the absolute climax of the battle later on, but here it's being used as a sort of opening trigger movement to start that pre-battle motivational speech. So, James, is that normal? And
yes, yes, it's absolutely normal to just grab a whole load of things that people say, put them on post-it notes, and just kind of wang them around a script until
I knew it.
That's very interesting. It does explain that why it doesn't feel massively coherent if it's just a load of a load of quotes that they've managed to smush together into a speech. But look, I think what causes the most interest is perhaps Blücher, the oncoming Prussian army's head. He feels like he might provide a little bit of contrast. You know, he's a little bit fat. He has a mustache. He is
Blücher.
He's not on time. So an English soldier rides up to ask how long he thinks Blücher's going to take. What's your estimated time of arrival? The soldier asks, which feels a bit of an anachronism.
Happy to be
corrected by people with historical knowledge. And Blücher says 5 hours.
Well, Google now, Maps says 5 hours.
In screenwriting terms, Alex, this is what we call a ticking clock. We're setting an expectation in motion that Blücher's arrival will be significant when it eventually comes.
Oh, I love the ticking clock. That is proper screenwriting technical jargon, which I think everyone will instantly understand.
Now, does it tend to be set at 5 hours?
Normally it's the nuclear bomb that will explode in 20 minutes' time, and James Bond has got just a few minutes to get the girl out of the simmering exploding volcano.
Yes, the simmering volcano. Yes, look, I think Blücher is the simmering volcano of this. He is the atomic bomb that's coming to change everything in Waterloo, but not quite yet. Not much continues to happen. Except one of the English snipers says that he has Napoleon in his sights.
Snipers.
The English snipers.
Come on, James.
He has Napoleon in his sights, but Wellington forbids him from taking the shot.
No, well,
that's not how the game is played.
Yeah, that line is
which
line
I'm sure that's historically accurate.
The line was there. How can maybe we can... Hey, we've got to use that line. How can we set it up? Well, let's get a sniper in. Ah! I've tried hard to hold back and be reasonable.
I'm not sure they had telescopic rifles in those days.
That's very interesting that even you, who doesn't fully understand the history of the period, has grasped that subtlety.
So look, we've got no time for this because Blücher is on his continuing approach. So we go back to the ticking clock. He says he's 11 to 12 miles away. Now, look, it does beg the question. I think I can walk about 3 miles an hour and Blücher is on a horse. Why on earth is he taking so long? But let's leave that to one side.
Well, they're not all on horses, are they?
No, I'm sure some of them are dragging cannons. I'm sure that takes some time.
That sat-nav, though, it does need a bit of work, that's for sure. I think there could have been a little bit more done with the out-of-breath messenger boy running to and fro between the armies. I just think he would have been a bit better with a Cockney accent.
So much would be better with a Cockney accent, Alex. Yeah, look, I think he wasn't much of a character. He had two horses. I called him in my notes Two Horse Joe. I'm not sure if that's his historical character.
Okay, yeah. Oh, come on then. Oh, God. Oh, my God. Let's go back.
Can't you go a bit faster, Blücher?
Look,
let's leave that to one side. Word gets back to Napoleon that the Prussian army is on the way, albeit very, very slowly, and he finds himself forced into action. Of course, that action takes the form of a tactic that has served him well throughout the ages. It's cannon time.
Big guns.
And never have cannons been so carefully pointed and shot than in this scene. So first they shoot them and the shot falls short. And then I'd say there's about 5 minutes of these guys adjusting the cannons, including one of the British soldiers shouting, "Adjusted," at the end of it.
Yeah, this is very, very Monty Python-esque, I thought. It's higher, a bit higher, no, lower, higher. Yeah. No, it was a bit overdone, wasn't it? We haven't talked about the trenches, James, as well.
Well, that's quite normal in warfare, isn't it, trenches?
Well, apparently not.
Trench warfare, that's why they call it that.
Apparently, there wasn't time to whip up a quick trench at Waterloo, because you do see I noticed in one of the very early Waterloo scenes a bit of frantic digging. There's a good spade being thrown with the earth being thrown over the shoulder, which I think was their attempt to show that, oh yeah, you could just quickly set up a quick little trench, that's fine.
I mean, it does explain why when the cannons are finally fired and they reach the British lines, one of the British sergeants' only orders is to tell his men to keep your heads down, which unfortunately they don't succeed in doing because many of them have their heads blown off.
Yeah, I mean, we're just into Ridley Scott crazy battle mode, aren't we?
We are. And look, perhaps for the last time in the film, Napoleon puts his fingers into his ears as the cannons fire. I think this might be the last time that we see this, Alex.
What a motif it is.
It's glad that we return to it. I'm glad that we return to it. So look, the battle rages on. There are a lot of Union Jacks on the field, I noticed. Could this possibly, and this might be a time for a history check, Alex, could this possibly be aligning an important historical coalition in the ranks of the armies that are facing the French?
Well, the story of Napoleon, a ladybird adventure from history, book by Eldegard Peach, published in
1968. The story of Napoleon.
Did I say it wrong? Yeah.
You did well. You put a bit of flourish
Napoleon.
On
it. It doesn't mention the football-like crowds. it was a little bit like a football match or other sporting engagement in which it was a bit like William Wallace and that climactic battle of the film Braveheart, brackets, sometime in the 90s, close brackets.
Yeah.
A lot of flags waving there. Oh, but in terms of that, no, I don't, there's not that many flags. That's too many flags. It's too many.
Is that what the book says? there weren't that many flags. What I'm thinking of, Alex, is where were the flags of the brave men of Nassau and Brunswick?
What?
Yeah, That's right. I went on the Waterloo Wikipedia before.
Well done. This is amazing. The Napoleonic community are going to be delighted that you are finally investing in beginning to learn about the period. Good for you.
In on the Wikipedia page, it says that obviously the term Waterloo has come into common currency, meaning an ultimate failure or endpoint, as per the ABBA song Waterloo.
Yes. Or the station Waterloo, the terminal station in London, Waterloo.
Oh, is that why they called it Waterloo?
Yeah, of course, because that's the end of the line.
I had no idea. I just assumed it was jingoistic nonsense. Anyway.
I just made that up. But who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? When you're in the kind of mindset that involves attempting to extract meaning from garbage.
Then you just, your mind starts spiralling, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's a bit like taking a drug doing this podcast. It's mind altering.
Yeah, yeah, not a good drug. Anyway, look, Napoleon watches the battle through his telescope, which weirdly I noticed seemed to make the troops look further away when he looked through it. I don't know if you noticed that, Alex.
It's the nature of optics to be a bit confusing.
It's possible that he may be looking through his telescope the wrong end. But look, he's got bigger problems than how to use a telescope because another horseman arrives telling him that the Prussians are only... And I can't believe how exciting this is becoming. Only 2 hours away, and he needs to do something quick before they arrive. And it's at that moment, Alex, and very soon, this will be the last time I say that, that the clock ticks over to the 15-minute mark.
And the Napoleon Movie Quarterly is obliged to press pause.
Yes, just as the English forces look as though they may charge.
No. What? No, it's the French charging. You have...
I don't think it is. I think it's the English forces.
Okay, well...
No, you're right. Wellington said don't, on no account charge. Hold your breath.
The other thing to tell you about is, on the day Napoleon had piles and was miles behind the lines. So as a screenwriter, James, how would you have maybe approached the fact that he had piles, he was well out of it, and that it was Marshal Ney... played by John Hollingworth, who's the guy with the hat facing in the right direction, who does a lot of the shouting, who's calling the shots. What would you have done with this piles problem?
Well, I would have... him kind of selecting a cushion would have been central to centers of the story. I'd probably have a whole scene on him, you know, working out how he's going to sit comfortably.
Maybe that's what Wellington was getting at when he spotted it through the telescope, and he was saying he looks like he's sleeping. He's just sort of shifting from one foot to the other.
Sometimes, as Ridley Scott's pointed out, I think you've just got to forget about these historical nuances and just, you know, I'd have had Napoleon chasing through the field, his sabre waving above his head, maybe riding a cannon into battle.
Well, whatever it takes. I mean,
look, it still may come, Alex. We've still got a whole 15 minutes to go.
Okay, so as always, I just like to do the three-act structure check. The threshold that was crossed, I think you were saying, was his return to Elba, or was it his exit to Elba? But it was one...
I think his exile to Elba, I think.
Okay, if you say so. So now we're into the main body of the third act, aren't we? And you've talked about the character being in his final state, so I see that, because he's content to face off against those soldiers of the 5th Regiment or whatever they were. But what else is there to say about the third act? And you talked about the antagonist as well, that late stage antagonist. That's very interesting. I want to hear more.
Yes, so the third act. The third act is very much about has the shape of rising action towards a climax, and then we'll have a kind of a brief period of resolution. But usually what you see in your third act is that your protagonist knows who they are. They've kind of overcome the changes that are going through in their character, but they have to sacrifice something in order to achieve what they truly need rather than what they think that they want. So Napoleon has worked out who he is. I think he's come back and he's embodying his destiny. He's become France. but he's going to have to lose something in order to prove that to himself.
Okay, so we talked about the tension between his ambition and then his love for Josephine. He's lost Josephine because she died, and also there was something with the valley about her letters. But is that done? Is that the sacrifice, the Josephine thing, that's not really a sacrifice at all?
Ooh. Well, that's maybe quite interesting. Maybe he, in order to become who he needs to be, he needed to lose Josephine. It's possible.
That's nonsense.
I mean, it is. I don't think that's right, because I don't think what we'll see in the next 15 minutes is Napoleon embracing his historic destiny. I think what we'll see is Napoleon coming to understand that despite all the things that he's gone through and all the achievements that he's achieved, that is not where he's going to find fulfillment. But, Alex, we'll have to wait.
Okay, I look forward to that. I forgot for a moment that, of course, you've seen this film, apart from that bit that you fell asleep in, but you were very much awake for this last 15 minutes, and so...
Very much awake. Can I remember much of it? No, but we'll see. We'll see. Okay. I should all come flooding back when I rewatch it.
Okay, so let's do this one last time. James, I think your camera's a little bit too high up. Do you think you could just lower it down a bit? A bit lower?
Adjust it.